This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's program, as usual, features two poets. And little did I know when I was planning this show that both of these poets have brand new books out from the same press, Wesleyan. We're going to start out with Kazim Ali, and then we're going to move on to Annie Finch. I will be introducing each of these poets separately. Let's go on now to Kazim Ali and Annie Finch. Tonight's program is coming to you from the kitchen of poet Kazim Ali, and that is spelled K-A-Z-I-M-A-L-I. We are going to be celebrating here his third book of poetry. His others are The Far Mosque, published by Alice James, The 40th Day, put out by BOA Editions, and now his third book is Sky Ward, published by Wesleyan University Press this year in 2013. He is also the author of two novels and two essay collections, Fasting for Ramadan and Orange Alert, Essays on Poetry, Art, and the Architecture of Silence. Welcome, Kazim.
Thank you for having me.
It's really nice to meet you and to see you. I have to start out by saying that this is one of those occasions when I wish that our listeners could actually see the cover of your book, Skyward. It's really gorgeous. There's a 17th century depiction of the fall of Icarus. And if you listeners want to take a peek at it right now during the show, you can go to KazimAli.com.
That's right.
K-A-Z-I-M-A-L-I.com. So before we open the book, let's talk about a minute or so, starting about with you, where you were born and raised, all of that good stuff.
Well, I moved across a couple of national borders before I was 4 or 5 years old. I was born in England, where my parents had had immigrated from India, but I did go back to India as a very young child and spent part of my early childhood there. And then when Pierre Trudeau opened the borders to Canada for South Asian immigrants, my parents and many others immigrated to Canada. So I spent 4 or 5 years in Canada, and then we settled in the United States.
Where in the United States?
Well, fortunately for me, we settled in the suburbs outside Buffalo, New York.
So, really? Mm-hmm. Oh, I spend quite a bit of time in Buffalo, New York.
Well, I love it. I love Buffalo and I love Western New York. And it was a very important part of my poetic life also, because the university was there and mm-hmm. Robert Creeley was the professor there at the time. There's a very active literary organization called Just Buffalo Literary Center. That became an important part of my life as a young student and as a young writer. Also, they supported me a lot.
Wonderful.
And one of my great poetic mentors, Lucille Clifton, of course, was also from Buffalo, New York. So we shared that in common. Although, I mean, I'm from the suburbs.
Which suburb?
But Amherst, where the university is.
I know where
but I say, is, when yeah. people ask, I say I'm from Buffalo, because Buffalo has had this rich literary tradition, including, you know, Creeley and Susan Howe was there and Lucille Clifton. And yeah. my dear friend Fanny Howe was born in Buffalo, New York. So I feel a great affinity with that city.
I've spent a good deal of time in the Poetry Center at yeah. University of Buffalo, going through their archives. It's just a wonderful place.
Mm-hmm.
I want to mention your teaching career briefly. You are an associate professor of creative writing and comparative literature at Oberlin College, a teacher of Jiva Mukti Yoga,
mm-hmm.
And a member of the core faculty of the Stonecast MFA program at the University of Maine. And fortunately for us, you're teaching just during this spring semester at St. Mary's College, which is why I get you here this morning.
That's right.
So, I mean, you have quite the life. When do you find time to write?
Well, it's for me, teaching really feeds my creative impulses. My job, my teaching position at Oberlin involves teaching poetry workshops, and I also teach translation workshops. So I'm teaching students translating from other languages into English. So students who are working with various different languages. And that act of teaching translation has been incredibly generative for me mm-hmm. in my own work and my work as a translator, translating other writers into English. It really helps me get away from the ego part of writing and the concern or the attachment to the results mm-hmm. of wanting to be successful, because I'm actually working on behalf of someone else. When I'm working on translating Sohrab Sepehri or the Mauritian poet Ananda Devi, who is a Francophone writer, I'm translating her poems into English at this moment. And when I work on their work, I'm working for them. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to make sure their poetry is as beautiful in English as it was in the languages that they wrote it in. So that allows me to suspend judgment, suspend ego, suspend selfish investment in the work, and really get at the heart of the poetry.
That makes a lot of sense.
And that's good training when I go back to my own work, where I feel that, okay, I'm doing this for a greater need and a greater purpose, and that it's important to write these poems and tell these stories, but it's not important in that it's going to reward me or make me successful or whatever that means in the world
make
of poetry.
Us rich, like
make
all
me
the
rich
of the world.
Right. It's that it's a more important act of generosity to be given
for the sake of the poem.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so teaching helps me. Teaching poetry also helps me do such a thing, because I'm working with other people, helping them to gain their own insights and to learn the craft as well. So it's been a joy.
Are there particular poets, especially the ones that you've been translating, that have really influenced your own work?
Absolutely. The big book that is coming out is coming out in November from Boa Editions, that also published my book of poetry several years ago. That is a book of poems by the Iranian poet Sohrab Sepehri, 20th century Iranian poet. That book is going to be called Oasis of Now, Selected Poems by Sohrab Sepehri. And he is a very mystically minded poet, but extremely grounded, not only in the daily world, but in a very conversational diction. So it was kind of hard to wrap my head sometimes around these very high concepts, metaphysical and philosophical debates about the nature of matter, but just tossed off the cuff in language you would as easily hear on the street or in a restaurant or a bar or something, just very casually spoken. And that really influenced me a lot in terms of, you know, how can you think about these things while keeping it very engaged in the materiality. Translating Ananda Devi, who I mentioned earlier, was also very influential for me, because she has written this book. It's called When the Night Agrees to Speak with Me. That's the English translation of the title. That is really about the breakup of a 30-odd year marriage and the aftermath of all of that that happened. And it's a very, very intensely and viscerally autobiographical book, and maybe even angry. And wears its hurt on its sleeve in a way that feels really direct to me. And that is not how I engage emotions in my own work. Right. I find it maybe a little distance, or maybe a little more artifice, and not such plainly, baldly spoken. And by translating those poems, by writing those French poems into English, I was writing those poems. I became the voice of those poems. I became Ananda Devi. That's the secret that every translator knows, that the reader and the publisher and everyone else in the world wants us to be as out of the way or as invisible as possible. Right. But what we know is we are actually writing those poems. We have become that poet in a way. Mm-hmm. Yes, they are not our poems. They are still her poems, and it's her voice and everything. But we are the writer of that book. And so when I was doing that, I learned how to be angry in a poem, or how to really wear my fear on my sleeve the way that she was doing in those poems. It changed how I was writing when I went back to my own work.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And is the work in Skyward indicative of that, or is that work to come?
So what happened was, I worked on Skyward, the poems that went into Skyward, for a pretty long time. The earliest poems in this book were actually... The earliest pieces of this book were from maybe 2003 or 2002. Mm-hmm. So this is even before most of the poems in the Far Mosque were written. I was working on some of these things. The bulk of the earliest part of this book is from around 2007-ish, okay, and then came all the way up to the present moment. I had to submit the final, the book was accepted by Wesleyan in the beginning of spring of 2012, I believe, but I had four or five more months before I had to hand in the full manuscript. And there were several poems, four or five poems almost, I think, that I worked on in the summer of 2012 that in their very early draft forms I put into this book.
Excellent.
So they're in there.
Good.
So this book has a full range of things that have been worked on for about 10 years mm-hmm. to things that were about 3 weeks old when I sent them in.
Love it. And
that's something else we learned from our, or I learned anyways in my poetic education not to do, was to really work on things for a long time. But it really, in fact, it's the last four poems of this book were all written in July of 2012. And I submitted the manuscript at the end of summer.
Uh-huh.
So I sent them in about 2 months after I wrote the initial draft of them.
I think it's nice that you do that, because just for you personally, by the time a book is actually put together and by the time it actually is published, put out into the world,
yeah,
you don't want to feel like they're all old poems, right?
Some of them are really fresh. Some of them are really fresh. And I was doing the Devi work, the translating Devi I was doing when I was in India, actually. I had been in Paris in November of 11, and that's where I found the book at a French bookstore. And then I went to India, and I was actually in the French, there was a part of India that was a French protectorate for a very long time, actually, including after the independence from England, and then they annexed into India. But I was there in the French part of India with this book that it suddenly occurred to me to begin translating it into English. So I worked on it December, January, February, into about February 12. So the last parts of, there are glimmers of that influence that came into this new book.
Good.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the title for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Two different words, sky, word, and immediately it sends us skyward. You know, it's the title sends us up towards the sky, or it can make the ward a prisoner of the sky, or, and I prefer this take myself, someone who is actually protected by the sky.
That's
skyward.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is there one meaning that you choose for this title, or do you like it being wide open?
Well, there isn't one meaning. There, mm-hmm. the three main meanings that you talked about are the ones. It's also as two words, a direction, skyward, and that word, skyward as a phrase does not appear in the book, but skyward as a direction, as one word, does appear
yes.
in the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the book was accepted, my partner, Marco Wilkinson, had come and he had joined me in India, and I was tearing my hair out about what to call the book, because the whole time it had been called Kazem Ali Untitled Poems. I didn't know what I wanted to call the book. We were in the northern part of India. We were in Uttarakhand at Vandana Shiva's, one of her research institutes mm-hmm. called the Navdanya Institute. Marco is a farmer and a gardener, and he's interested in sustainable agricultural practices. So we were there doing that, and we were going from there to Kerala. So from the very north of India to the very south, and we got on a boat in Kerala, and we were trolling around the backwaters on the boat. So imagine that, going from the frigid... Mm-hmm. And this was in January, so we were freezing, and then we were in the sultry tropical area, dragging this untitled book along, having a good time, doing a lot of different things, but I was just tearing my hair out about the book. And at some point, we were just sitting on the deck. It was the evening. The crew members of the boat had cooked us amazing dinner and had brought us tea, and we were just shooting ideas back and forth. And I knew I had to, at some point when we were getting back to land, several days from then, I was going to have to send Susanna an email, because the advanced publicity, we had to start moving on all that stuff. And I had to have a title for her. And there were many different permutations, but he's the one who came up with this concept,
oh,
Skyward.
Nice. Well, it was a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you mentioned your partner, and that brings me to the next topic here, because you are Muslim
mm-hmm.
and you are gay. So the connection between these two parts of your many faceted self is a theme you've explored in the past. And again, you look at it again in Skyward,
That's
among
right.
other things. So, you know, this is a conflict that many gay people with any religious background face, whether it's Islam or Christianity or whatever. So In your poem, Handwritten Notes of the Screenplay for Bright Felon, the movie, there are the lines, "Because of troubles with the union of you, the role of Kazim will be played by a figure of stone." And in another poem, Confession, you have Icarus saying the myth is, quote, "only a story spun to warn back heathen sons who burn too brightly." Absolutely, you know, beautiful line. But, you know, of course, there are a few questions that come out. First, how have you come to reconcile the teachings of your faith with your deepest self, your sexuality, assuming that you have? That's the first question.
Well, I am a Muslim. I believe in the basic, very basic tenets of the faith. And I see my understanding in that context. But I'm also a practitioner of yoga, and I take that very seriously. So there are beliefs from both of these two that intersect perfectly. And I find that we each have to choose what our engagement with what we call spirit, we'll put it in quotes, is. And sometimes we can do that in a community. Mm-hmm. And we find a community and we engage in it. And sometimes we have to go our own way in order to do that practice. And I know, yeah, I just taught at St. Mary's, and I have a student there who is himself he's affiliated with some kind of religious order in his church, but he's a solitary practitioner. So he's on his own. He does his practice and his meditation or whatever his spiritual regimen is, but he's not living in a monastery or anything mm-hmm. like that, for example. And you find that in the yoga tradition also. There are people who practice in temple. There are people who practice in community. There are people who have to go their own way. And in Islam, it was also like that. There are many people who, you know, congregational prayer is a huge part of the faith, but there are many people and have been many people throughout all history that have practiced an individual practice. And many of these people are great saints or holy beings in Islam and are recognized as such. So I feel like we should not merely see following any religious system that exists as a monolithic concept. You know, Hinduism itself was sort of identified as such, given a collective name in response to the Muslim invasion of India. Before that, there was a whole network of beliefs and texts across the entire subcontinent that were not really thought of as a unified system. And Christianity and Islam and Judaism, they are all like that. They developed over hundreds and some cases thousands of years with a set of different thinkers and a set of different texts and a set of different tenets and beliefs. And so in one sense, I was born Muslim, I was raised Muslim, I was given those vocabularies and languages for different unnameable concepts. I know the Arabic words for them, so maybe I'm wired in a certain way to understand. So I still use those words and I still use those concepts, but I'm in a constant state of questioning or wrestling with these. Fannie Howe wrote a wonderful essay called Doubt. It's in her book, Gone, and she talks about doubt as a spiritual tool, an important spiritual tool, that engaging or that thinking is a part of a practice of a religion.
A type of curiosity and opening.
Yeah.
Well, in your poems, you write in kind of a fractured, multifaceted style too, and I wonder if this style of your poetry comes out of the conflict of, you know, Islam and self.
I think many things at once. And I think I want to express many things at once. And I think the self is multiplicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Walt Whitman famously said, "I contain multitudes."
Right.
So I often thought about, what do I believe about God? Do I think, because Islam teaches God is this unified thing, it's separate from a human, there is a heaven that's removed. Yet in the ancient yoga scriptures, it teaches that we're all the same, that we're all part of that matter. Mm-hmm. So I got worried in my own little brain. Well, what is it that I believe? I don't really know. But mm-hmm. I think that all these things are possible at once. I mean, I think infinity is infinite.
There you go.
And we have to try to seek ways of an awareness that it's one doesn't equal one. And
this is a very ancient teaching. I mean, outside of any one religion,
sure.
too. It's such a common teaching about multiplicity.
Yeah.
And we are the multitude. And, you know, it looks like we're two separate beings, but scientifically we're not.
We aren't. Yeah. And the trees are not. A forest right. is like, genetically speaking, if you want to talk about genes, genetically speaking, the plant that creates another plant, it's actually the same plant. It actually isn't a different plant.
Right.
So Marco, my partner, used to say that maybe a plant that grows another plant next to it, it's just, it's the plant's way of walking, but it's walking so slowly that we think it's a new plant is growing. And
yeah.
so I think that what if the humans are, I mean, if you see those stop motion pictures where it's like different shapes and it's your, so maybe like a new person, it's actually just a progression of
right.
the same. I think there's a lot of different things that we don't understand about the physical universe, but that reveal spiritual truths as we discover mm-hmm. them. And it's so much is yet to come, you know,
if
we can
little.
Manage to preserve our environment and right. ecosystem and all of that in time to learn all these things.
Right.
One hopes.
Well, why don't I cut you loose now and just let you read a number of poems from Skyward.
Okay, that sounds good.
So this is Kazim Ali reading from Skyward.
This poem is called Fairy Tale. In the acres of garden before an empty house, an amnesiac prince collects broken branches, prunes the fruit trees, plucks weeds from the rock bed. He speaks a broken language of beach and Broadway, and on the way to shore gets lost and finds himself in a cemetery at sunset, pink light on the stones. He cannot read the inscriptions, but kneels down at a cenotaph anyhow and recites the only prayers he can remember. Why, when we wanted to speak to nothing but water, is he singing verses down into the stone-hard earth in a town he has never belonged to, lost on his way to the shore? If only he would learn to read the book of the sky, he would see the birds circling lazily around hot currents, which could only mean a large body of water is near. The words are hollow in his mouth, and he doesn't know what he believes anyhow, whether bodies will again rise, or if the aerial rumors of the gulls will lead him to the sea, or if the numb tombstone in his mouth might indeed speak. His scripture comes out sideways, and his mispronunciation of the most sacred of syllables makes him always friendless. It's nearly a party trick the way he opens his mouth and butterflies pour out, closes it again and the clock chimes, reminding him of being a young boy, coming home to an empty house, sure that he had been forgotten, that everyone had gone to the beach without him. Sure that he would always be forgotten. That he would lie down in his grave and no ghost would come fetch him or explain God or what was supposed to happen next. That the grave would fill with dirt and he would rise on the boat of his body. That no one would recite sacred chapters for him. That he wouldn't know how to take the rudder. That the sea was too far. The boat now coming apart, his voice dwindling, hard as stone. Finally, he sees a bird winging down, calling, "Find me, find me." But he doesn't understand words, only sound, the shape of words, the tune to which they are sung. All the sacred verses in the world are like birds wheeling in the sky. Who knows where they go? Every night, the clouds argue in the sky for the right to be the one who will part to reveal the new moon. Blank, but appearing, day by day, a new misunderstanding of gone. How can you already know if you have never yet been? the twin inside arriving after departure, the crime of history, a quivering vessel, my also bones, a manic making. Who am I? A man inside a bell, inside someone else's face? Fingers that hold a skull or pen. Of course, a swan could be an elephant, or a man could be on fire. The coffee I didn't drink is pouring through time, and inside any city, a thousand vowels pronounce themselves. Every street map has a thousand pointing arrows, each labeled, "You are here." But who are you? At the corner of San Anton and Duende, dark-eyed and holding your empty. Nobody knows you, hardly arriving and already gone. This poem is called The Escape. Many of the poems in the book Skyward deal with the myth of Icarus and the labyrinth. This is one of them. The Escape. Father whose purpose swims while the universe mends itself. Wind was water, porpoise was profit. Father my swim, the sutured eventual blue splinters. Seed planter, hedonist, heathen when the unwise sun fell to pieces, purposeless when the father flew for cover. The cloven will cleave. The water finishes itself, finishes me. Stream unreeling, you are the end of the world, an endless horizon. It's a sham, this charnel choice between heaven and home. Finally, free of the labyrinth, and overhead, nothing but sky. I did a long poem, 8-page poem in sections called Ocean Street, and it was devoted to Alice Coltrane, a great musician and holy being who had an ashram. She retired from music and became a renunciate, a swami, and had an ashram outside Los Angeles. The ashram is still there. Alice Coltrane has left her body and lives in the spirit at the moment. So this poem is a short section of that long poem. And I wrote it in Santa Cruz, California, and I was standing at the ocean watching the surfers surf in and thinking about Alice Coltrane. Always awakened, awakened and left, reft the weights, blue, hollow, sightless an oracle trying to tell what recedes and what's left. A shirt left crumpled in the sand. In the mist you balance on a board the shape of a prayer book, racing along the surface toward the rocks, finding in the water a pounding afterlife. Sound that undresses itself, prayer book spun to unravel, answering the eroding cliffs and dunes. Dear orange shafts of late morning, speaking backward and in tongues. Wet-suited supplicants balancing on boards, racing for shore. How did you find yourself deeply in the forest on the ocean floor? Dear snake-haired woman who wondered, to some the book in sound you wrote was thunder. It is one thing to be lost, another to be left, seeking a slogan, a sloka, your own body. Dear country dark, house-flown home wrecker, shy in the blackness, telling how you sailed again to arrive, to found yourself in sound. Dear, hold me, scene or sign, the unsoundable notes saying, dare to leave home, drop everything. Did the universe write them, or did you?
This is Catherine Hastings. You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. We're going to return to the poetry of Kazim Ali, A-L-I, and the background noise you hear on this recording is a refrigerator. We are recording this segment from a kitchen where Kazim Ali was staying. Let's return now to Kazim Ali reading from Skyward.
This is another poem about Icarus, poor Icarus, dear Icarus, left in the middle of the ocean, treading water. It's called Adrift. Oh, the diminishing racket of voices calling my name eclipsed by the new moon and indiscernible dark. I have somehow become the center of the universe. I wept for a year on the open water, strangling myself with banishment, sensation vanishing into the depths. The rain, a faded photo from 15 years ago. I am a forgotten bit of metropolitan trash tied to his moment of redrawing the border between twilight and daybreak, forever at the edge of something that could save me, and the disastrous fear of what it would take to save me. My life, in its entirety, only imaginary, or perhaps the rapturous notion I cannot be saved. This is a poem called Promise Keeper. I wrote this poem in Jerusalem when I was visiting there. The Dome of the Rock is a very important place in the life of, in religious life in general. In the Muslim belief, the rock is the place from which the prophet launched into heaven on his night journey. It's also the place that Abraham is said to have sacrificed his son Isaac in the Jewish tradition. And in biblical tradition, some say it's the place upon which Adam and Eve first entered the world when they left the garden. So this is Promise Keeper. In the place mountains keep time as they slide into the sea, you made a promise you never kept. You fastened yourself lonely to everything that lived, wanted to open every closed door, wanted to turn your back on the sky and teach yourself how to fly. Speak in the language of myth and flowers, if you must, but translate it at least for the stone and dust. You built a tower to God out of bricks and mud, when you should have built it with breath. Wings will not carry you skyward. Your own body is the only mosque you need. The tongue in your mouth, the only rock from which you could ever launch yourself into heaven. So we left Icarus much earlier in the book. We left him adrift in that poem I read to you. And around page 47, we left him. And then there were no more Icarus poems throughout the rest of the book until this poem on page 76. So this is the comeback of Icarus. It's called Confession. I'm drifting now, cold and stolen, the sunbound one, giving lie to the myth I fell. Only a story spun to warn back heathen suns who burn too brightly. I saw the feathers flutter down like pages from the old man's book. Dead scared of heights, I am the wrong boy for the job of proving gravity's limit. But wings are small things invented by men who could not but cut the cobalt sky from the sapphire sea. But I want to weave blue and blue together. So when the feathery pages sink damp beneath the waves, the ink streams clear to nothing. The story goes, I drowned. Dear God, Father of Light, I must excuse myself from the formula. Nothing adds up to me, an equation desperate to be solved. I abandoned wings and sun for the blue direction. And by the flowers in my mouth, I swear I will find some place on this earth that knows me. This is a poem called The Promise of Blue. I initially wrote it when I was invited by NPR to participate in the poetry games. And we were each poet from around the world, several poets from around the world were contacted and asked to write poems about Olympic sports or athletes. And I wrote this poem about Greg Louganis. It's called The Promise of Blue. In the end, there was another poet who also wrote about Greg Louganis, who put his poem in a little bit earlier than mine. So I was asked to do another. So the poem that I eventually did for the poetry games, it's also on the NPR website. It's called The Wrestler. But this was the first poem. So I feel like I'll put it on the radio now. And as I was writing about Greg Louganis, I did a lot of research into his life, and he's an amazing, amazing man who's done some wonderful things with his life since he's left active competition, including he takes care of animals and he is a teacher. And so I found him very inspirational. But as I was writing the poem, interestingly enough, I was at the tail end of all this Icarus stuff, but this is one of the poems that I wrote in the summer of 12, that one of the newest poems that went into the book. So as I was writing about Greg, I discovered, well, he is also a boy who fell from the sky into the water. So he's right. So Icarus is about Greg, but it's also an Icarus poem as well. It's called The Promise of Blue. So here it is. The Promise of Blue. What we wanted was to watch him silver fall, cut the surface of the water and leave no bruise. Every earthbound angel who was taught his body was a sin calculates in his head equations needed to sculpt the air as he aims from grim height for the promise of blue. Always smote by lightning, disobedient boys tumble in a tangle down to drown in the well of others' rage or their own sorrow, thirst to again return skyward, unbloodied and held close. But to leap is to know. The body is the equation the sky has written, and around the body that launches, space unfolds its shape of wings. Blue water and blue air are the same substance and within. He turns into currents and tides surging in place and swims the endless distance down, soars sleek through the cold depth. Now, years after, he still sings the eerie air as he walks along the shore. He still knows the secret that every moment in the body and breath, one can still plummet and plunge and soar.
Thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure sitting with you today, talking with you, and then I selfishly get to sit here listening to you read your poems.
Thank you very much for having me, and it's been great to read them to you, too.
When are you coming back to California once you leave?
Well, California poetry organizers, I want to come back very soon.
Good.
Often. So we will, I've been talking to different people and who organize the readings and such in the area, and I hope to come. I mean, I fell very much in love with the Bay Area. I have so many friends here. There's wonderful yoga here, really good spirit, wonderful poets, amazing literary scene.
You may find yourself living here someday, from the sounds of it.
From your mouth to God's ear, perhaps.
Yeah.
We'll see.
You stay in touch with me.
I will, okay? Yes, of course.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
You've been listening to an interview and a reading with poet Kazim Ali, K-A-Z-I-M, A-L-I. We're going to move on now to a recording with Annie Finch. Finch has published more than 20 books and chapbooks of poetry and poetics. Tonight she's going to read from her most recent collection, Spells, New and Selected Poems, out from Wesleyan University Press. If there's time in the show, I'm going to include a reading she has on CD from her book, Calendars. She is known for her rhythmic writing and performances, And she's a graduate of Yale University with a doctorate from Stanford University. She has published many books about poetry, including the anthology Villanelles, named one of Garrison Keillor's top holiday gift books, and the very popular writing guides A Poet's Ear, A Handbook of Meter and Form, and A Poet's Craft, A Comprehensive Guide to Making and Sharing Your Poetry. This particular recording with Annie was made in Boston in March of 2013, and she begins with a poem that she wrote for Carolyn Kaiser. And it's wonderful for me to hear this again. Annie Finch, along with Joyce Jenkins and I, recently visited Carolyn Kaiser. It was in October of 2013, and Finch read this poem directly to Carolyn. It was a very special moment. Here now is Annie Finch.
Because we're in, because this is being aired from Sonoma, I'm going to start with a carol for Carolyn, dedicated to my dear mentor and wonderful poet, Carolyn Kaiser. It begins with an epigraph from Kaiser. A carol for Carolyn. It's easy to be a poet, brim with transparent water. From Carolyn Kaiser in the first stanza. I dreamed of a poet who gave me a wail that shadowed clear pools through the kelp-making shade. When beached sea foam dried on the rocks, it would sail down currents that gathered to pool and cascade with turbulent order. She brims with transparent water as mother and poet and daughter. The surface is broken and arching and full, impelled by the passions of nation and woman. The waves build and fall, the deep currents pull toward rocky pools, cupping the salt of the human. The ocean she's authored brims with transparent water for poet and mother and daughter. This is my answer to Andrew Marvell's poem To His Coy Mistress, the one that begins, "Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. I would love you 10,000 years before the flood and 30,000 years to each breast, and all our lives to praise the rest." Well, this is my answer, coy mistress. Sir, I am not a bird of prey. A lady does not seize the day. I trust that brief time will unfold our youth before he makes us old. How could we two write lines of rhyme were we not fond of numbered time and grateful to the vast and sweet trials his days will make us meet? The grave's not just the body's curse. No skeleton can pen a verse. So while this numbered world we see, let's sweeten time with poetry, and time in turn will sweeten love and give us time our love to prove. You've praised my eyes, forehead, breast. You've all our lives to praise the rest. I wrote that one when I was a sophomore or junior in college, and I've never recorded it before, so it's nice to do a reading of it. And this is another one from around the same time, my very first sonnet, and I'm reading now from my selected poems, so I'm reading some poems that have never been gathered in book form before together and that I've never recorded. This is Still Life. A sunny afternoon, think of Vermeer. Here is the apple. Here, the rounding side of the blue pitcher. On the scrubbed wood, just here, she puts the pitcher down so that the slide of drops against its lip catches what light there is for pitchers here this afternoon. She does not even see the drops or quite attend the blue, a common thing. But soon the tide will turn, and salty smells will rise to circle in the street. And to her ears will come the voices, then doorways to her eyes, then other days than this, afternoons, years. She will stop to hold this moment near and drop the pitcher and betray Vermeer. I'm going to do another poem I love dearly that I wrote a long, long time ago. The August Porch. One afternoon, I think I like it better for cut browns, apples, lumber, than evening for the raveling of slats to emerald. There's no gleam to the wicker. Shadows might well not be cast. The trees are scanty with the weight of apples they have finished. But wisteria raises its inchworm head and hunts for the walls of this porch. Something's waiting to run out on us. The mist and creak of wines is due when we run out of dusk. I think I was about 14 when I wrote that one. And I'm now going to move forward to the new poems from this book, Spells, New and Selected Poems. I'll read some of the newer poems in the book written in the last 8 or 10 years, and then I'll close with some poems from Calendars. Blessing on the Poets. This poem was written for A Poet's Craft when I finished writing that book, which is a collection of everything I know about poetry. The subtitle is A Comprehensive Guide to Making and Sharing Your Poetry, and it took 15 years to put everything in this book. I didn't want to just end it. I felt I needed to end with a blessing, some way of ending on a poetic note for the sake of all the readers who are going to be reading that book and using it to write their poetry. And that became the first poem in my selected poems, Spells, A Blessing on the Poets. Patient earth digger, impatient fire maker, hungry word taker and roving sound lover, sharer and saver, muser and acre, you who are open to hide or uncover, time keeper and hater, wake sleeper, sleep waker. May language's language, the silence that lies under each word, move you over and over, turning you, wondering, back to surprise. Now I'm going to read a birth poem and an abortion poem. I had my daughter, and then a year later, I had an abortion. I'm going to read them one after the other. Home birth. Home is a birthplace since you came to me, pouring yourself down through me like a soul, calling the cosmos imperiously into me so it could reach to unroll out from the womb where the wild rushes start in a quick, steady heartbeat, not from my own heart. This is my body, which you made to break, which gave you to make you, till you bear its mark, which held you till you found your body to take, open at home on my bed in the dark. Abortion spell. Let's keep the world through its own balanced kiss. The kiss come from women made of our own blood. The holder, the cooler, redeeming the earth, shaping the room where we give you your birth. Hands born of women will not stop this flood, this generous, selfish, long-opening gift. And this is my memorial for 9/11. It's now been installed in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York, and accompanying the wonderful sculpture by Meredith Bergman. The naming. Lopez, Juergens, Lozowski, O'Connor, Lomax. shoes and spirals, dust and the falling flowers. Diaz, Dingle, Galetti, Di Pasquale, Catsimatides. Wounds widen the remembering earth. Closed eyes see beyond the flames. Grief opens hands to feel the wind. Heart beats like ocean and hears the names. Di Stefano, Eisenberg, Chung, Green, Dolan, women running suddenly in their high heels, Penny, York, Duarte, El Ferris, Sliwak, Yama Madala. Closed eyes see beyond the flames. Grief opens hands to feel the wind. Heart beats like ocean and hears the names. Wounds widen the remembering earth. Weinstein, Villanueva, West, Sadake, spirals, dust and spiraling, dust and hours. Bowman, Burns, Kawauchi, Buchanan, Riley, Reese, Agnabene. Grief opens hands to feel the wind. Heart beats like ocean and hears the names. Wounds widen the remembering earth. Closed eyes see beyond the flames. Cushitane, Oltzhofer, Wang, Ferrugio. Breathed in only in or beyond the naming. Inglaterra, Samus, Linkantatatsum, Colonatado. Heart beats like ocean and hears the names. Wounds widen the remembering earth. Closed eyes see beyond the flames. Grief opens hands to feel the wind. Sanchez, Talbot, Aflito, Siskopoulos. Every question with a long sob of naming. Tarantino, Zempoalakatl, Thorpe, Koo, Stergiopoulos, Zion, Zinzi, Song, Shahid, Santiago, Ortiz, Pabon, U, O'Neill, Newton Carter, Miller, Mohammed, Zachary, Campbell, Deming, DeFranco, Chowdhury, Blackwell, Zucker, McDowell, Goldstein, Basmajian. Wounds widen the remembering earth. Closed eyes see beyond the flames. Grief opens hands to feel the wind. Heart beats like ocean and hears the names. Here's my poem in honor of Earth Day. I think it's April 20th. It's the celebration of the environment and the planet. Earth Day. All we want is to find the love in the faces of the people we love. All we need is to find the dark in the nighttime sky, to lie down to sleep in the darkness where stars and moon keep vigil in the silence of a sleeping earth. All we require is to wake to sunlight in the morning, to simple sky, to breathe aloud as the sky is breathing, to drink the water of the earth. All we need is to touch the planet and find it clean where we were born, where our ancestors breathed and planted, where we live with the plants and birds. All we need is to live with the memory of a future we want to imagine. All we want is to find the love in the face of the planet we love. The next poem is dedicated to all the wonderful places where poets and writers and artists can gather and talk, whether they are cafes, libraries, bars, restaurants, bookstores. This was written about a cafe, and it's called Revelry. Chairs root, their trunks are runged with snow. Curtains grow velvet thick like bark, in this warm landscape ringed with dark. Is passion only revelry? Voices believe words and move free. Lust moves our lips. Blood fills our skin. We bend alive around cup and cloud. These are the hours to revel in. I'm going to read another early poem, which is the title poem of my book, Spells. It used to be called Liturgy. Then when I put the book together, I realized it was that if I had known then about a spells, I would have called it a spell rather than a liturgy. And that is how I think of my poems, as spells, as ways to use sound and language to make a change in consciousness and in the world, in a physical way as well as a mental way. Spells. From music I bore some gold stone fins, but they sank away through the waffled shallows. From nature I gleaned some hope of rice, but it edged deep away in sunk stone bowls. So then I asked for bowls and fins. I asked for a hand that could gather them back into finning the shallows, gilding, rounding. I guessed me a hand that could gather bowls open. When I had asked whom I had guessed, she sent my asking out. Now, over and over, she sends it back. Over and over, it answers me. Over and over, it answers as she gives it, in the speech of fins and in the speech of bowls. So I wasn't sure whether to read this one, but I'm dedicating it to our host, Catherine. At her request, I'm reading A Dusk Song, which was written just in the same year as Spells. Over the big bed in the small room, the flat shadow turned, thinning our walls insistently, turning and turning us closer and closer to salt wind in from the sea. I could sing a song about a long-gone lover, Cape Cod dusk, Cape Cod shadow. I sang a song then about the Cape Cod shadow, over door and wall, over shoulder and shoulder. Did I have a face, and did it lie in shadow, turning and turning your glances away? Once there was a song about the Cape Cod shadow. I sang the song. The flat shadow turned over our walls and brought the sea in. The song kept turning. What I love so much about this book was putting these poems together from so many different parts of my life. And there's a whole section of poems from the 1980s that I called the lost poems because they waited about 20 years to be published. And then these very early ones also have never been published before, That Dusk Song. Nobody's ever heard it or seen it before until this book came out yesterday.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to Annie Finch reading from her newest collection of poetry from Wesleyan University Press called Spells, New and Selected Poems. We wanted to record more poems that evening, but it just didn't work out that way. But I'm a big fan of Annie Finch, so I'm going to produce another show with her using the CD calendars, and it is Annie reading from her collection of poems called Calendars. So you can look for that coming up in the year 2014, early 2014. Before Annie tonight, Kazim Ali read from his latest book, also from Wesleyan University Press, Skyward. That's Skyward. I want to thank both of these poets for appearing on tonight's program, and I want to thank you, the audience, as always. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's program, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.